the campaign was, I mean, you're running in 48% and then for Congress in 50, basically, it's just a, and then in 50,
and the party had to,
the party.
Yes, the party had to expend so much energy in 82 counties. They had to have a percentage of registered voters, you know, and you had to always get many more than you thought, in order to even get on the ballot of Michigan. And that was a big Herculean task, to, because of the regulations there in Michigan. And after they did all of that, and of course I did that kind of work also, I wasn't above doing any kind of work. After they did all of that, I thought that I would do the best that I could. But no, I wasn't thrilled about it. It wasn't my natural forte.
You recall what kind of, when you did speak, what the issues you were speaking about?
I don't recall, no. I know there were always issues that were very, very close to the auto workers, the organized workers, because this is the thing that usually concerned us in our paper, newspapers, and so on.
It sounds almost as if during this whole period when you were back in Flint, that your heart was really more in the kind of, the broad-based organizing at the Unitarian Church and in the NAACP, and you kept up your party work, but your heart wasn't in that as much as in that other work.
Yes, I guess you could say it that way. I was a very loyal person in the party. If I belonged to something, my criticisms will be inside the organization, but I will carry out my responsibilities.
What sort of active things did you do in the party? Were there study groups or?
Yes, mm-hmm. We had study groups. We had the SWP fraction within the. And there again, when you get into Flint or Detroit, it's something totally different than any other kind of a city. You have your auto fractions, where you have reports of what's happening, election campaigns, or issues that you're promoting through the membership meeting. You try to recruit new people to belong to this particular group that you have working. Through that, you do a lot of your educating, an awful lot of your educating. The issues that were brought up in the union movement, some of them we initiated. Others were initiated by other people. You have discussions within your auto caucus that apply the ideas of socialism or Marxism to the actual events of the day. Why is it that this might sound very attractive as a solution to a problem, but it only leads the workers off and not understanding where the real problem is, and so on. And then we had regular classes in Marxism. We had our weekly lecture at our meeting, our regular meeting, we usually had a lecture.
Now, at this point is when I think you were saying that the party was about 30 to 35 members in terms of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And you were doing a lot of writing for the militants, too?
Not a lot of writing. I was doing some writing. I think that outside of the party, I was probably the most active of any other member. The others were within the UAW and the party, and there, you know, and I was working in the other organizations plus participating in the union caucus meetings in the UAW because I knew a lot of the people, I knew the international leadership, and so on, and I participated in that also.
Mm-hmm.
Deciding on that tactic and strategy. For a while, the Chevrolet division was so fine, so beautiful in the things that they proposed and the way they organized the workers to go about attaining it, that I concentrated then more on the outside activities because they became, you know, they learned how to operate themselves very well.
Then in 53 is when you were also when the everything
came to a head and you were expelled from the party. Now, Paul was in the PB sanitarium at that somewhere in there. He'd been working at Chevrolet, and then he was saying the other day that when you were expelled from the party, he was in the PB sanitarium. Yeah, when the final expulsion, they threatened us once before. I think they suspended us or they threatened to, and we backed them down on it. And as a result of their backing down, we were able to come out and say, these were our positions, and this is why we felt that they didn't have the right to expel us. And we began to win over more people. I think we must have had about a third of the membership. When the actual expulsion came, James Cannon decided he couldn't wait any longer. This was it wasn't developing as he had hoped that it would. So Saul was in the TB fan at that time when we actually got the expulsion.
And the issue, I gather, was that the feeling was that the situation changed with regard to the union, given the red dating that was going on, and given the change in the workforce and working conditions, and that it was necessary then to organize more among the students and intellectuals and not devote all the political energy towards workers through the union movement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was the key.
Yeah, we wanted to go into the universities. We wanted to go into the Unitarian church groups and places like that. And we felt that it was just impossible to try to continue to speak in our own name and run our own candidates. And that was the domestic issue. And there was also a big discussion going on about China. How could China be a worker state without a proletarian revolution? It was a peasantry there and so on. And so there were both international mm-hmm. and domestic issues.
And how did you feel about the expulsion when it did occur?
How did I feel about it? We were sort of prepared for it in Michigan. I was insulated. It was people who were outside of our state that really got shocked by it, you know. I think I was prepared for it, and I felt that their positions were so futile. And they were citing the same old business by rote. Marx said this, and Lenin said that, and you can't give up your party, and speaking in its name and under its banner, and all of these things in this period of intense red dating, you know, we're getting thrown out of the shops and everything else. And so our whole Michigan section just said, well, good riddance then, to hell with it, you know. And so we kept contact. We still carried on our activities as though. They didn't contribute anything to our labor policy anyway.
Mm.
The SWP had very inexperienced people as far as labor is concerned. The only thing that they had was some good people who came out of the Teamsters in Milwaukee,
Minneapolis.
Well,
what effect did the expulsion have on the role that you all were playing in the UAW locals?
None. If it wasn't widely known, we made a mistake by not coming out in writing and giving the issues that were involved because many people thought maybe it was just a tactic due to the period. There were some people who thought it was just a tactic that we would say we were not members of the SWP. Others who knew about it, and very few people really knew about it.
Mm.
We were so interested in the vital issues that were touching the workers themselves. Other people who knew about it, they didn't think anything about it. They'd only dealt with us anyway, you know.
Mm.
They knew us as having a militant socialist policy
mm-hmm.
and a fundamental approach to questions, and it didn't make that much difference.
Well, does this mean that you shifted your focus away from the trade union work,
no.
Actually, or did you continue?
Oh, no. The union work continued right along.
Mm-hmm. And what about then?
But the only thing that, from now on, you won't hear too much about union participation per se is that because when Saul got out of the sanatorium, he went back to work in the automobile factory. He had high seniority in this one particular plant. And after he worked there for a little while, he began to feel weak again. And it was just too much of a gamble. So he came home and he said, and this is something that is shocking. Anybody who had seniority sometimes can be a very reactionary thing. Anybody who had seniority in that city wouldn't think of giving it up. You know, it was some kind of guarantee of a steady job. And we decided, you know, that he should give it up. And yet I didn't want to move from Flint. And it was a big decision because I didn't want to move from Flint. It was, you know, my whole life practically, my family and everything. So when he gave it up, we had a pretty rough period, really.
Well, did he then,
Yes, he would. Did he do? He sold in, say, Encyclopedia Britannica. Once you're out of the shop with your reputation, there's nothing that you can do. Encyclopedia Britannica, he sold health juicers, fruit juicers. And this he covered all over the state. Couldn't make a living at it. And then we got a real estate license, both of us did. Yeah, we were selling real estate. And it was a friend of the town that once General Motors goes down, and we had a recession then, just as we got going in real estate, we had a recession, and it drove seven brokers to the wall, real estate offices to the wall. And my God, then again, it became very, very difficult. You'd get a commission, and then you would eat for so long. So I went back to work through the gracious help of a union young woman in the credit union. And she got me in the office workers union. And this office workers union in that area was quite a reactionary little outfit. You know, they had very, very good wages and very good pensions and very good everything. And they just didn't need any wild-eyed radicals like me. Can you imagine the union that I built? But after I got in the credit union, they accepted me.
So you were working in the UAW credit union?
Mm-hmm. Chevrolet credit union. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so as?
The Chevrolet local is a very large local, and then it has its own credit union with deductions coming from the paychecks right over into the credit union.
Oh. Okay.
They make loans, they finance automobiles and home improvements and so on.
So this would be in about 55, it sounds like.
Does it? I think it must have been.
Yes,
because let's see. When we left, I left from the credit union, so it probably would have been about 57.
Oh.
I imagine.
Now, and then from 53 to 56, you were involved in the Socialist Association that was publishing the American Socialist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were you directly involved in it, or was that mainly Shaw?
I was a member. Mm-hmm. We had hoped that we could appeal to the intellectuals and put out a magazine. It was a very nice-looking magazine, and it was written on a high intellectual level because we felt that this is the turn that we had to make, but the time wasn't right, and we could not finance it. And so that just sort of faded away. I don't know, after 3 years or something. Mm-hmm.
Once you started to... How long did you work in that credit union? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I'm sorry, I dwell so seldom on any part of the past like that.
You basically, during that period, kept up the work in the Unitarian Church and the NAACP,
mm-hmm.
is what your political activity
yep.
is?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how old is Ron?
Ron is 26.
Now, when?
Ron was born, Ron was about, let's see. Ron was born in 1952, and when Saul was in the TB fan, is when I had to put him in one of these WPA nursery schools and go to work, you know, put him there early in the morning and then pick him up at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would have been 54 I was working there before, yes, probably about 52. Maybe, when I went to work, it must have been when he was about a year and a half or two, maybe two. I can't remember that. What?
That you went to work.
52, and Saul was in the sand in 53, wasn't he? I don't know.
Uh-huh.
When Saul was in the sand, I was having to take him to, I was working then.
At the credit union.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, was it difficult having a small child again?
no, it wasn't. It was a big relief because I took a lot of, you know, a little small child. And that was the reason I went up. I was in a mess for a while over the other two boys. And my own family doctor, who had saved my life so many times, suggested that we have a child. And I said, you're crazy. I could never take that again. Absolutely crazy. And I had these nightmares and so on from the other situation. It was a traumatic thing. I lost my mother, my father and my two sons all in a period of 4 years. I didn't get a chance to really, and my mother was a big help, a big mainstay. So if someone said that there was some kind of a Dr. Connison in New York, and he then had some kind of an injection, that if you had some very disturbing a mental problem, sometimes they could, throw your metabolism out of whack, and glandularly he could treat you for the things and make you feel better. So I went there to Dr. Connison, and Sal took me there to his office, went with me, and then he went off somewhere else, and he said he would call back for me. So Dr. Connison saw me, and I told him all of the things that had happened to me. you wouldn't believe. I'd had a house burned down. I'd had all these things. Such crazy things. And he said, well, my dear, you've had a rough time, haven't you? Listen, do you mind waiting for just a little while? You sit in this room, and there's some magazines and so on. And when Sal came back for me, I was still in this room reading, and Dr. Connison greeted him. And he said, I'm afraid she's more serious than I thought. He said, you should hear the things she told me. And he saw went down the list. He said, oh, she's forgotten a couple. So then he actually thought that I was making all this up. So he prescribed something, and I didn't want to stay. And I went back to my own doctor in Flint. And my own doctor gave it to me. It was something that he had to have the whole story on before he would stop directing the veins. And it helped me a little bit. But, yes, when I had to run as a little child, it was a great... You can't even get your mind off from it completely. Mm-hmm. Your mother, the loss of your mother and your other two sons and so on. And he was a great source of enjoyment.
Then in that period before you had so much financial difficulty too.
Yeah.
So Paul was in the sanitarium and you went to work and Mom was in a nursery. And you take him
Very scientific one. Mm-hmm.
So you continued working then from then until you actually moved to Detroit in 50?
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1950, Saul got a job in Detroit. Was there a decision?
He went down there first.
Is that it?
Well, the decision was made for us. There was absolutely nowhere, and my office job could not support a family of three. There was absolutely nowhere that he could find a job, and he's a very energetic person. But he was blacklisted, too, mm-hmm. in this company town. And finally, a friend of his recommended that he go to work for Israel Bonds down in Detroit. And we thought perhaps, I didn't want to leave Flint. I thought perhaps he could commute back and forth weekends.
What's the distance?
60 miles. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't very satisfactory. You know, the weekends coming, daddy coming in and going out.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very satisfactory. And so finally I decided that I would move down there too. And by this time he had found a home. And the first 6 months I was getting settled and moving in all of this. And then... I went, Ernie Mazie kept coming over all of the time asking me to do volunteer work for ACLU typing. And then he asked me to go on as secretary because they had no full-time person for the ACLU of Detroit. And I did. And then he came out as executive director, and we then organized 7 branches in the state of Michigan and made it a very, very dynamic organization, exceedingly dynamic.
What was it like when you first came into it? What was most of its work focused on?
Well, they had some older people who just didn't have the energy to keep up. And I remember that the desk, they had a little room in an office, and the desk was filled with appeals for help and a lot of prisoners. Appeals for help, and they were so heartbreaking. And they had never been answered, hadn't been opened. The doors were closed. And it just took us, I don't know how long, Ernie would come from work. And it took us so long to write replies to these people. Maybe they had written 8 or 9 months ago or a year ago or God knows, I don't remember the dates. That was the first type, just trying to get the thing sorted out and writing to people and telling them if we could take the case into consideration or if there was another case precedent, case pending somewhere. That would also establish their question, you know, resolve their question. And then as he came out, he also was a very dynamic person. Coming out of the SWP, we'd worked together, you know, very closely. And all of misconception work, And then we took on all kinds of cases and brought together a very, very dynamic and active board. And those people are still functioning in Michigan. They don't have the organizational pizzazz that Ernie and I had, but they're still functioning in the nation. The most beautiful article on Skokie, Illinois was written by Carl Cohn of the University of Michigan. Those are the kind of people that came around in that period.
Now, you were big involved in it. It sounds like there was no real strong chapter or office functioning at this point, but you and Ernie were involved in really setting it up.
Yes, and then we kept expanding, and we got a very, very efficient, very large set of offices in the Washington Boulevard building downtown in a nice area of the city. And I took on the development, that is fundraising and membership drive. And he went into the substantive issues. But as all of my life, this was one of the best men that you could find as far as human liberties and human understanding was concerned. All of my life, I was working again with a very, very good, definite male chauvinist. Ernie Macy was a very big male chauvinist. It was very hard. I could chew him out and rail at him, and he would take anything from me. He had a great deal of respect. And he would just say, "But you know, you're unusual. I don't look upon you as a woman. You're unusual." And that used to infuriate me. And when they had luncheons discussing certain issues, I'd say, "Ernie, if you want me to go back and ask these people for sums of money, I've got to get acquainted with them on a basis such as going out to lunch with you." But he could never accept that. He just couldn't accept it. "Well, your work is separate, and I don't know what they think about my bringing a woman." And he didn't put it that bluntly. I mean, he really didn't put it that bluntly, but "I don't know what they would think about my bringing you in artificially if you weren't involved in this court case or some other matter." And it was all a question of chauvinism with him all the way down the line. And, of course, he was he was quite a woman's man all of his life. He bragged about it, you know. And his secretary had performed numerous services for Ernie Macy, which didn't bother me, except I was never accepted on a par with him. And he had more respect for me, often told me many times, than any other woman he'd ever known. But this you find all of your life, you know, no matter where you turn. The credit union, I used to give the manager of the credit union all kinds of ideas to enhance his prestige and help him write up his board reports and everything else. But he took all the credit, could never admit, you know. And in fact, he was a little hostile because he had to depend on me. He didn't really like me. He was the whole story when I left for Detroit.
You know, what was your official title then in the ACLU? Was development director?
Yeah, for the state of Michigan, for all the branches.
Does that mean that you travel around
the occasionally, state? Occasionally. I was very good at letter writing, and after I had gone to these branches and met these people, I can develop a rapport with people that I'm able to carry on through letter writing.
Mm.
It's just, I'm no great writer, I'm just an intimate. I can talk very intimately to people. And I got a great deal of cooperation from Kalamazoo and from Ann Arbor and Lansing and all these places.
And this was a paid position.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was while you were working at the ACLU that the Women's Petite, you became involved in the Women's Petite.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall the initiation of that activity or how the group began?
No, I remember meeting when we set up our groups in Michigan, going down to Ann Arbor to establish them, and meeting Belle Abzug. She's very young and very attractive and very dynamic then. She's dynamic still, but I mean she was a very attractive young woman. And I used to, because of my activities in the ACLU, I would go now and then to meetings, but as we became a little better organized, you know, through the churches and our coalition and so on, I began to take a little more active role in the organization that I liked working in the best. And we called it the Detroit Women for Peace because of the labor movement. We were part of the Women's Strike for Peace, but there it had the connotation of going out on strike. So we just dropped the strike in Detroit and called it the Women for Peace. I did have a little difficulty with the CP in it. I felt that as the wife of the Communist Party, the editor of the Communist Party, should not have publicly become the treasurer and let it be known, you know, and things like that. As a matter of tactic, after all, it was known generally that I was not a member of any political party at that time, that I was a member of a socialist group with a magazine, but there was no function. And she, on the other hand, was a very, very well-known and very active spokesman of the Communist Party. So on little things like that, we had differences. But otherwise, the rest of them were very pleased to have me to elect me as chairman. I was not chairman when I first came in the first couple of years that I was a member. I would go when I could. But then when I took over as chairman,
yeah,
we had...
Yeah, chairman was the chairman, so that's how we could probably date it. At the time that...
Alice Hertz? Yes.
Because that was 65 then.
That was 65. Mm-hmm, okay.
So probably from pretty early though you were probably the chairman, since that was 65, and it seems like it formed nationally in 61, the end of 61.
I think it was 62 in Michigan. I don't think that the formed in Ann Arbor until it was maybe a few months or a year later.
Now, the chapter for Detroit and Ann Arbor were the same chapter?
No. This was our state meeting that we had.
Oh.
We had a little group in Lansing and a bigger group in Ann Arbor and then the main group in Detroit.
Now, what was some of the... Most of the issues revolved around the ban the bomb movement. Before the U.S. involvement in Vietnam,
what
some of the other things that you were working on?
Nope, that's the one that stands out. We had great activities with the coalition of peace groups in Detroit, and primarily we had the largest Methodist church had a minister who was an ACLU man, a liberal. And from way back, a fine reputation, Henry Hip Crane, who was known nationally, especially in Methodism. And he and the ministers of his church took a very, very prominent role. And whenever we had parades through the city of Detroit, very large parades, they would go in their long robes, you know, their black robes and their shawls or collars or whatever they are. And yes, demonstrations, uh-huh. Emil Mazie would come out to speak for this coalition group, and we got a lot of publicity, a whale of a lot of publicity. We had an Easter parade one time that just filled the streets. The whole main Woodward Avenue was a big parade. I don't know how many wide, maybe 10 people wide. I've got some little snapshots of that. And we had the Women for Peace itself maintained. Not only did we have meetings where we had lectures and discussions and book reviews and things like that, but we maintained a picket line in a little triangle, and I can't think of the name of that triangle, downtown Detroit, with our signs every single Saturday, all day long.
A weekly vigil.
And was that
already into Vietnam days?
Yes, that was into the Vietnam War. Uh-huh. Because that's the way that Alice got the idea of immolation. She read about some Buddhist monks, and she mentioned how much courage they had, you know. And when she actually decided, she said nothing to her daughter nor any of us. And I got a call, about 5 o'clock, I think, one morning. Yeah. No, I got a call at 12 o'clock the night before. That was it. And Alice wanted to know, had I sent her to any meetings or any place? Had I known where she was going, or had I asked her to speak before? Because she was and her little broken German, very, very effective. She escaped from Hitler with her one daughter, left the rest of her family there. And she's very effective and 80 years old, a remarkable woman. And I told her, no, absolutely not. I said, in fact, Helga, she's been having a few little dizzy spells, and I've asked her to curtail her activities because she would come out if there were going to be four people meeting, she would come. And so I went to sleep, and the next morning, oh, that was it. Yes, I got this very late call at 12 o'clock, and I asked her to call, check with the police station, asked about identification. We had a little talk to Helga and I. And the next morning at 5 o'clock, the news came on and said America's first torch bomb case was reported here in Detroit. And I didn't even have to wait for the name. I knew who it would be. She went up close to Wayne State University and took cigarette lighter fluid, doused her winter coat, and lighted it. And a man jumped out of the automobile and tried to smother her. And for a few days she lived. And we were hoping, she would have been a vegetable had she lived. We were hoping that she wouldn't, because we wanted her to, you know, be a success in her protest.
Did she leave a note indicating?
Nothing. Mm. Nothing. She knew everybody would understand.
Mm-hmm.
And
what
was
the reaction in the city?
The reaction in the city was horror at first. It was a shock. It was a huge shock. Many people did. Many people thought, oh, this is a, you know, one of those peace nuts. But the Unitarian, the big downtown Unitarian church had a service, and I gave a beautiful, beautiful little sermon about why she did this, you know, her higher motives and so on. And it was headlines in the Detroit papers and the papers of Michigan, but we noticed, after I wrote to a number of people, that it had been stopped. After the one big, you know, announcement, it was stopped outside of Michigan, the borders of Michigan. Absolutely squelched. The rest of the newspapers in New York and other places where I thought they would hear about it hadn't.
Mm. Yes. Now, do you recall, how large was the group in Detroit
Women for Peace, that was a strange organization. I think we must have had about 50-some members, but we had small meetings.
Mm-hmm.
There would come one meeting, and it was an odd group, a very odd group of people. I think that, well, for one thing, it's very, very hard to maintain a vigil. The young women did that. And I think that they just felt they didn't have the energy to put forth to go out on some of the things that we wanted done all of the time. We were carrying on. If they had to write letters or something like that, they would do it. And they didn't see any necessity for having to come out regularly to meetings, but they did see a necessity. So there was a big coalition demonstration or writing letters. And we did keep them pretty busy writing protest letters, sending cards and things like that.
Now, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, were any
family
members involved in it?
Oh, there were maybe two or three women that would, crossed over. They maintained their own separate organization. And theirs was the same kind of organization there in Detroit. I think Detroit was a town of the coalition and the demonstrations.
Mm.
And otherwise, their meetings were very small, and like ours were.
But you were able to, when there was a demonstration, all the groups
worked
together.
Oh, yes. Then we could get a big turnout.
Now, at one point, you went to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But you recall when what that was around?
Oh, that was the Vietnam War, protesting to picket the White House. We had groups from the Women's Strike for Peace all over the nation taking turns getting into Washington. And every week we were keeping a picket line before the White House. And when it came the turn for Detroit, we were mobilizing, and at first we were going down by, plane. Some of them could go by plane, and others wanted to go by train or bus or something. So we had, instead, Mrs. Cyrus Seaton in Cleveland offered, if we could get to Cleveland, that we could get on the bus, her plane, and all go down together. And it was a very large private plane because, you know, she was in a wheelchair. So we did that, and we were extremely grateful because it made very nice the Cleveland people and the Detroit mm-hmm. people and the Ann Arbor people all together. I think Joyce Kornblue was part of that Ann Arbor group. If I'm not mistaken, maybe I am, no.
Let me Skype the people. Right around the time that Alice hit.
I suppose it would.
What I recall is that earlier, most of the focus was on the disarmament and then the bomb. And then in 64, five.
I see, on that kind of a thing, I think we must have had about 40 or 50 women from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kind of women that, you know, would come out for something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have a very good contingent.
Yeah, the whole time that you were there, you were...
Esther Bloomer just went down with us.
Oh, you were going to tell me a story about that, in fact.
Oh, I don't want to put it on here. It's just some crazy little thing. We just held up two buses for that little gal. She's a very charming, charming individual. And she's poetic, and she... very often just gets lost in her own thoughts, and we were to meet back at a specific time at the bus, you know. And the members were just about ready to decapitate me. They had waited long enough. I don't remember whether we held those buses for 45 minutes or something like that. And then down the street, she had a little Scotch plaid tam o' shanter and a scarf wrapped around her neck like this, and a little loose coat. Down the street she comes twirling the parcel off her old scarf, and she comes up and she says, "Well, it was wonderful, wasn't it? And the sun is shining so bright and I said, Esther, get on there or they're going to lend you." She's terrific. They were so angry with me because I could not possibly have gone and left Esther. Oh, maybe we even waited an hour. It was unbelievably long. All those people on two buses waiting.
See, what I recall is the earliest demonstrations with specifically in Vietnam was, I recall, the Declaration of Conscience against U.S. policies in Vietnam and the Dominican Republic. That was in 65. I remember that thing. And then, Mrs. 65 was, oh, she did leave a note.
She did leave a note?
Mm-hmm.
Where was it?
She said, that's the note saying, "I choose the eliminating death of a Buddhist to protest against a great country trying to wipe out a small country for no reason."
Hmm.
She died 10 days later.
And something like that in the bathroom. Oh, that was, yes. She didn't leave a note to Helga. I think that was found in her purse or something like that.
Mm.
Because Helga had no evidence in her home, no place. Yes, I think that that was supposed to have been for the students, primarily in that area. That's why she went to that area.
While you were involved in the Women's Peace Group, you were still working for the ACLU.
Mm-hmm.
And getting increasingly
satisfied. Yeah. I had a remarkable group of volunteers that used to come down and do so much work for that organization. It was a group of young women, mainly secretaries, that would come from all the buildings around that Washington Boulevard area in downtown Detroit. And they would usually get something to eat, or they would bring in their own sandwiches sometimes. And we would have 7 to 10 of them every single week come in to do catch up on all of the work, save a whale of a lot of money. And they were such dedicated young women, and as we were doing this, we were discussing questions such as feminism mm-hmm. and civil liberties, and it was such a loyal group. They gave me a farewell party, and I think there must have been about 40 people at this farewell party when we left. All women, dedicated as hell.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come in to work on the pledge cards,
mm-hmm.
and out of their little salaries, they would get proportionately much more than people that, you know, had big names and did a lot of talking. Yeah, they'd pledge $10 a month or something like that, and they weren't getting big salaries at all, you know, little jobs.
Now, how did you decide to come to L.A. then?
Well, yeah, this because of the pressure of the job and because of personal pressures within the organization. By this time, Ernie Mazie was a very well-known man in the state of Michigan. He was a very competent man, and he was on television practically. If you didn't see him two or three times a week, you knew something was missing. So many issues, and he had such competent people all over working in all of the various parts of Michigan, working with him and for ACLU. And he was always the one to issue the statements, and he was asked to speak before the police academy. Can you imagine all of these things? And this man was great on expanding activities, but he could never manage his own financial affairs. He was always in debt personally. But Saul and I one time gave some kind of a party to get him out of debt to the tune of $2,500, and we raised it when he first came to Detroit. But anyway, we know that everybody has weaknesses, and we were willing to put up with all of this until it got to the point where the activities kept expanding, and we were going up and up and up and up, and I was working my head off. I even beat the recruitment and support 1 month of California, which was a phenomenal thing because nobody else in the country could do it. And I couldn't raise enough money to keep up with this. Or if I was raising it, I was raising it. And the pressure became too great, you know. And then when it came to a question of more assistance, I only had one secretary and all these volunteers carrying on this underpinning of this big organization. When it came to the question of more help for this part of ACLU, he decided instead to put on a full-time attorney and beside his secretary, and instead of relying on the volunteer attorneys, one full-time attorney, to direct all of the volunteer attorneys, because that, you know, gives ACLU more publicity. And it was on the, it was done from a good logical point of view that it should recruit more members. But unfortunately, you have to do a little bit more than just get publicity, you know, you have to do a little bit more than that to get them and get the income increased. So Saul had been working very hard in the editorial buttons of Detroit, and every so often an opening would be posted on the board in his office, and he would call me down at the office and joke with me and say, you know, there's an opening in Kentucky, or there's an opening in St. Louis or someplace. I said, bully for them, you know. And wouldn't you like a change? He knew I was under pressure, too. And I said, nope, I'm not leaving Michigan. I came from Flint to Detroit. I'm not leaving Michigan. And then one day he called me and said there was an opening in L.A. And I was just, I think we'd had some kind of words in the office that morning or something. I was just at my wit's end, and I said, put your application in for it. And he said, wait a minute, we better talk about that when we get home. So we talked it over, and he said, are you very, very sure? And I said, absolutely. So he put his application in. And I had told Ernie at this time, Saul's putting his application in for transfer to Los Angeles. He went all around the Jewish community to find out, is it possible Saul's going to get this job? By the way, at another point when I thought I couldn't take it, I had put in an application to Wayne State University for some kind of a job. Boy, that job name now, what was it? I know I could have done it much better than the person who got it. And the Board of Five was considering me. Ernie was out of town, and when he came back, he got to those people and had it stopped because he didn't want to lose me from ACLU. And this killed me.